This is Ozarks at Large. For about 2,000 years, maybe more, what humans knew of geometry was shared through a book compiled by Euclid. We really don't know much about the person, Euclid, but we do know the principles and rules he collected were used to teach students for a couple of millennia into the early 20th century. And next semester, students in the University of Arkansas Honors College will be able to watch the evolution of Euclid's legacy and the 20th century move away from some of the principles he compiled in a signature seminar that will be co-taught by Edmund Harris, an assistant professor in the math department at the University of Arkansas, and Joshua Youngblood, the head of instruction and outreach in special collections in the University of Arkansas Library Rare Books Collection. I talked with both of them recently by Zoom and asked them about the legacy of Euclid's book, both in the terms of mathematics and in the terms of general education. We hear from Joshua Youngblood, the rare books expert, first.
I'll let Edmund speak to the importance to the discipline of mathematics, but just as a book. And that's one of the fascinating things about the conversations we've had for years now about Euclid's Elements, but also just math texts and textbooks and books in general is the transmission of knowledge. And how does that knowledge evolve? How does the text evolve? And then how does that relate to books and texts as objects themselves? And so Euclid's Elements is the most successful textbook in history, and maybe even the first textbook. And it's also was in circulation, if you want to call it that, for years and years and years. And it was handed down. It traveled geographic locations, through languages, through religions, through different mythological worldviews, through all of those things to make it all the way to the 19th and into the 20th century and 21st century now with me and Dr. Harris giving our class. But, as a book, it's one of the most widely read books. One of the things that our class and our ongoing discussions will look at is the importance of the book during the book transitional periods or early modern period. So how does this thing that was passed down through papyri to manuscript folio, written down on vellum, passed from monastic understanding to monastic understanding, become a print object, and then a really, really important print object, which then influences not only mathematics, but then what is print book? What is the meaning of the book? How are books used?
It was a summation of the mathematical knowledge of a particular point in time, the bringing together and the coordination. And it's not the case that this is the results that Euclid found. This is not the mathematics of Euclid. Nearly all the mathematics in the book is far older. And especially, some of it, we know that it was discovered in the ancient Greek world or the Eastern Mediterranean. Alexandria, of course, is in Egypt. And that was the center of mathematical study. But a lot of it coming from ancient Babylon, coming out of different parts of Africa. But it is this really well-documented collection of the mathematical knowledge of a certain period. So from that point of view, it's this sort of great window into the past. And then you have the fact that up until the 19th century, it was actively used as not just a textbook, but the textbook for geometry. And it's still usable as a modern text. I'm teaching geometry at the University of Arkansas right now, and one of the textbooks is Euclid's Elements. And so it's quite usable as a textbook in a modern mathematics class. Now, part of that is because in the 19th century, when people started to really look at the foundational ideas of mathematics, how the logical structure of mathematics could be built and try to. So at that time, a lot of paradoxes were being dealt with, especially around calculus. People had found that calculus didn't work quite as well as everyone assumed. There were some issues with it. So the question was, how can we have faith in mathematics at all? And one of the ways that question was thought to be resolved was to go back to geometry and the way that Euclid's Elements sets up geometry. So it sets it up by creating a series of statements, of rules, and then those are all you're allowed to use. So you have some basic objects like points, lines, circles, And if you have two lines, there's some rules as to whether or not they intersect. And if they intersect, what can you say about that intersection? So you have this structure that you basically set up your system, and then you can start to do stuff within that system. But you can only do the things that you've either said that you can do, or things that you've shown you can do within that system. So the first proposition is to take those rules and say, we can construct an equilateral triangle on a given line. So now, anytime I give you a line, you know that you can create an equilateral triangle. So this idea, which is sometimes called the axiomatic method, was one of the ways that mathematics went to solve the issue of how can we trust that mathematics is correct in some way. And so one of the reasons you can use it today in a modern math class, when you couldn't use some other texts in the same way, is because it played this important role in setting up new, the way modern mathematics is done in some ways. The thing is, at that same time, Euclid as geometry was becoming less important. So the structure of Euclid was becoming more important, but at the same time, geometry was becoming a lot broader than the elements. And in particular, you have ideas of what are called non-Euclidean geometry. You can see the importance of Euclid even when it gets pushed aside. So non-Euclidean geometry is the geometry you need to have in order, for example, to deal with general relativity.
Joshua Youngblood with Special Collections. Will there be examples from the university collections included? I mean, physical examples that students can see from the university collection?
Yep. So one of the things that we've done over the last couple of years, as Dr. Harris has developed his history of math and his literature of math instruction in the Department of Math, and as we've partnered, but then also as we started thinking about what a class like this could end up being, Special Collections has grown its collections very intentionally. Something that we're very proud of in the university libraries is our ability to respond to, anticipate, and work with the needs of programs on campus. And so we add, whether it's an archival collection or it's a rare book or it's things that are being published now or electronic resources, of course, we're always trying to meet the research and learning needs of campus. For this class in particular, we've added several examples that students will be working with. And these are extremely rare and very interesting, fascinating books that students will actually be using to do research projects. Through the history of math instruction we've done, Edmund and I have had the chance to look at a 1607 edition of the elements that the library's had in its collections for decades, since the early 20th century. And it's great because it's this chunky, big textbook like brick of math that was published in 1607. And students have been able to use that if they knew it was here, they could request it themselves, just like anything from the university libraries. But to add to that, we recently acquired a 1537 early Latin edition of Euclid in the original binding, just like a textbook that you would have had to have special access to, say, a university in Basel, Switzerland, which is where it was published, in order to see this book. But this is, we've talked about the word reverence. This is a reverential object, if you look at it in that way. But it's also just a textbook, but it's a textbook from the 16th century. We've also added a very interesting publication of Euclid from 1847 by Oliver Byrne, which is beautiful. It has meaning with it that really goes beyond just the study of geometry, because it used a four-color printing method.
Wow.
It's this gorgeous, gorgeous book, but also is a very fragile book because of paper technology in the 19th century and how paper would degrade. And there actually aren't that many examples of this book available in any library, much less in public university libraries. But we have one here at the University of Arkansas. And so students will be able to work with these rare texts, as well as supplementing that with an array of digital surrogates, digital collections available from other universities and other researchers, and then maybe taking some of those ideas and maybe even playing with them in the digital universe themselves. So taking images from our books and then seeing what they mean and seeing what how they can transform them.
Edmund, I want to ask, because we're talking, you know, when you were talking about non-Euclidean and the first proposition and the fourth, and you can see that's wrong now, this is more on the two millennia since Euclid. I mean, we're going to give Euclid a kind of a break because it was 2,000 years ago and he might have been working with the best that he had at the time?
Oh, I mean, absolutely. I mean, as I say, that the picture of what mathematics could be then, I mean, and we're not criticizing Euclid as an individual. We're criticizing the text. And criticizing not in the sense of trying to bring it down, trying to destroy it. I mean, it's something I absolutely adore and love. But I think, you know, that's something, as somebody who grew up in Britain, we, you know, learning about the history of the British Empire, to both be proudly British and deeply ashamed of the past and some of the aspects is something to bear in mind. And I think, as I was saying, with objects of reverence, it's sometimes declared that it's wrong to criticize them. Mm-hmm. And I think that is a deeply flawed idea. If something is robust and important enough to be revered, then it's also robust and important enough to be criticized and to be analyzed from multiple points of view.
I can't wait to hear about how the class went. Joshua, I can't help but think of somebody in the early 16th century getting that 1506 copy.
Wait, 1607, 1537.
Okay. They get this copy. And then they find out that there's a revised edition and they have to buy the new one and they have to sell that textbook back.
Well, you know, we don't need to talk about publishers and publishers' profits, but you know, the textbook industry, this whole other, we'll call it a sub-thread throughout the class. Now, it's interesting that you mentioned that, though, because, for instance, the 1537, there is an earlier Greek from 1533. We're talking about printed books. So 1537, there's a 1533. There's one from the 1480s, which is a really, really important text. But even then, you know, every time you have a revised edition today, it's like, oh, there's a new preface or somebody else wrote an introduction or, oh, there's more critical notes in it. But you can see that in the real object. So if you look at the 1537 versus the 1607, which again, students are going to be able to look at both of those. There's the format of it. The 1537 is a big folio book that's in this leather bound thing. And the 1607 is a compact brick, which you could imagine someone actually putting in their, maybe not a Jansport, but you know, whatever satchel they have to carry around with them. But even in the books themselves, in the text, how the text is presented, there are important differences. So in the 1537, one of the really fascinating things about that book for me, and I can't wait to talk to students about this, is it has an introduction by Philip Melanchthon in it, who is a humanist thinker. So it's published in Basel, Switzerland, at a time of a great exchange of ideas and also rapidly changing religious and political environments. And the introduction to that book is from this humanist leader and humanist thinker who also happened to be interested in math. But he puts a preface to this book so that you can understand Euclid, and that's very particular to this early 16th century mindset. And then also in that edition is Proclus, a Greek thinker, is in there too. So you have both these people in that edition, and that's very different than the 1607 one. What's fascinating is how the diagrams and how the block printing, because each one of these editions we're talking about has different illustrations. Those had to be handmade. And sometimes, just like the text itself, it's based on earlier versions. And sometimes it's changed or it's transitioned. And you could see the same diagram in a 1607 or even an edition of Euclid from the 19th century, from the 1800s. They'll have the exact same shape of intersecting lines or ways to illustrate a proof that you would have seen drawn on in a manuscript from 1100 or 1200. And that's a fascinating thing to see how this text is both a baseline of learning and referred to, but then also how it's adapted continually over time.
Edmund Harris is an assistant professor in the math department at the University of Arkansas. And Joshua Youngblood is the head of instruction and outreach in special collections in the University of Arkansas Library Rare Books Collection. We talked with both of them recently by Zoom. There is more, so much more to hear about this topic, and you have a chance to hear more with both of the men delivering a free virtual lecture preview of the course at 5:15 tomorrow evening. You can learn more about the lecture and how to register for the free event at the University of Arkansas Honors College website or their social media pages. The course will be available for students in the U of A Honors College next spring.